Bethany Hamilton once ranked as the best amateur teen surfer in all of Hawaii. She lost an arm, however, to a tiger shark in October of 2003. Both her compassion and competitiveness, however, have reached a new level in her life. Soon after the attack by the shark, she began to raise money to restore a man's eyesight. And while visiting New York City, she gave her ski coat to a homeless girl. When asked about the gift, she said she had more than she needed in life. Referring to her competitiveness, the story in USA Today states, "As always, Hamilton remains undaunted. She has told her father that if having only one arm proved detrimental to reaching the top in competitive surfing, then she'd see about playing soccer." Her pastor, Steve Thompson, said, "She's looking forward to the future. She's asking herself, how can I show the world I still have a life, that I enjoy my life, and that my life is filled with joy? She has an underlying trust that God is taking care of her." She has an underlying trust that God is taking care of her. Faithfulness to the Lord begins with faith in the Lord. When we trust the Lord for our future, we can be faithful to Him in our present. No matter what we face in life, we can live with confidence if we trust the Lord and know that He is in control. David learns this lesson in 1 Samuel 26 this morning. David is back in the wilderness of Ziph, on the edge of the barren landscape called the Jeshimon, which is another word for the Judean wilderness, a very desert-like region next to the Dead Sea in southern Israel. The Ziphites betray his location once again to Saul. David's been down this road before. The Ziphites betrayed him before to Saul, and now they do it again. God is testing his faithfulness once again. Does David trust God to take care of him, or will he take matters into his own hands and solve the problem his way? That's God's test. David's been tested in this way before. He's being tested again here in this chapter to find out which way he will go. Principle number one, then, trusting the Lord helps us pass His tests, God's tests. Verse 1 of 1 Samuel 26, "Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, 'Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon?' So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen men of Israel, to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul camped in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road, and David was staying in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army. And Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him." So David and his men are hiding out in the wilderness of Ziph on the southwestern edge of the Judean wilderness. It's a wild and barren area where David can be relatively secure. He's been hiding out here over several years at this point. The Ziphites, who are loyal to Saul, once again betray David's position to Saul. Betrayal is hard to take. Maybe you've been betrayed in life. David has been betrayed now more than once. And the injustice and the struggle and the feelings that he must be going through are very powerful feelings. They did the same thing back to him in chapter 23. Saul gathers 3,000 of his top troops and arrives in the area to pursue David. David's spies carefully track Saul's movements so he knows where he is and what he is doing. This time, however, instead of running away, David chooses a different strategy. He came to scout out the army encampment. Obviously, an army camp of that size would need some level space in order to set up. David and his men could use the mountains and the hill country around that area to spy on, to get a good look at the enemy camp. David locates Saul. He locates Saul's chief of staff, Abner. He scouts the locations of the sentries, the layout of the camp, because David is not waiting for Saul to find him this time. David is going to go to Saul. He has a strategy in mind that is exactly opposite of what happened before. Verse 6, then David answered and said, they're looking over the encampment now. He said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people were lying around him. Then Abishai said to David, today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? David also said, as the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But now, please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let's go. So David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away. But no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. So David asks for a volunteer to go with him into the camp of the Israelite army that night. Abishai, who is David's nephew, jumps at the opportunity. Abishai and Joab are brothers. They are sons of David's sister, Zeruiah. Zeruiah is David's sister, and it's kind of odd that these men are introduced as sons of the woman, because in that culture the man was always identified, and yet nowhere do we ever have a husband of Zeruiah identified. They are always identified as the sons of David's sister. These men will become very important and very loyal to David over the years. They will take up roles in his government in the future. Abishai, is a warrior. So is Joab. They are both going to get a reputation as bloodthirsty men. They are powerful soldiers. They fight. Abishai's bravery never is in question. He is not afraid to face any foe, and we would see that if we studied the life of David all the way to the end. So he's just the sort of man that David would say, how about if you go with me into the camp on this rather foolhardy expedition? The two men sneak into the camp that night. Normally that would be an impossible task. The cover in the Judean wilderness, there is none. It's just wide open desert area. So to sneak past sentries into the very center of a camp is basically an impossible task, especially since soldiers would be on the alert, and they would be tasked with that on pain of death. They could be killed if they fell asleep and did not protect the king. But we know from the end of this little section how David was able to accomplish this. It wasn't because he was so superbly stealthy across those rocks in the Judean desert. It was because God had put a deep sleep on everyone in that encampment. You see, this is all about what God is doing. God is setting this up. God has put it into David's mind. God has set all of this up as a test for David. It's a test from God. Now, David will be tempted once again to kill Saul. Temptation doesn't come from God, but God uses temptations as tests of our faithfulness. And God allows this temptation as a test of David's faithfulness to God. Will David take matters into his own hands, or will he trust God to take care of matters. Which will it be? It's a matter of faith. Abishai is quick to seize on the opportunity. He offers to take Saul's spear and kill him on the spot. He's very confident of his own abilities as a soldier. He says, basically, I'll not have to strike him twice, David. One stroke from me and he's a dead guy. All right? I know what I'm doing. Let me do it. He not only says that, but he says, David, God has given him into your hands. This is God's way of taking care of the problem. God's done it. Now, that's a very reasonable argument, if you think about it. If he has this opportunity, David's already had this opportunity once before, and he turned it down. Now he has the opportunity again. David, God's giving you a second chance to do this. If God's giving you a second opportunity, surely he's waiting for you to take some action here. I mean, how many times does God have to solve your problem for you? How many times does he have to put him in this situation? David, surely it is of God. Surely it is God's will for you to take this action. Sounds reasonable. I mean, how many times did God open the door for you? And how many times do you close the door that God has opened? It's God's way of getting you out of the mess, David. All of us out of this mess. Well, David once again obviously refuses. Instead, he takes the spear and the water jug. Maybe didn't trust Abishai with the spear for too long, anywhere near Saul's head especially. David will trust God to deal with Saul. He will not take matters into his own hands. He trusts God. He passes the test once again. Now that raises a major question for all of us in our lives. How do you know when the opportunity to act put before you is from God or not? How do you know when the door that is open has been opened by God or not? It's an open door. Is it from God or not? How do you know whether it is God's way of answering your prayers or a test from God whether you would trust Him for His faithfulness? Those are tough questions, and we face those in life from time to time. Is God guiding me in these circumstances, or is God testing me by these circumstances? Well, the answer, the partial answer anyway, is bound up in the moral will of God. There are boundaries that God places on our actions. Within those boundaries, there's freedom, but there is not freedom to violate those boundaries. So we cannot disobey God's law to follow what might appear to be God's will. God won't lead us to sin. That is never God's will, no matter how inviting it seems. It's always a temptation and thereby a test. David knew it was sin to murder Saul. No matter how great the opportunity it is, it's not God's will. No matter how open the door seems to be, if the open door requires us to sin, if the opportunity requires us to sin, it is a temptation, not an opportunity from God. God never calls His people to sin in order to follow Him. So that's the first set of boundaries in determining whether this open door is of God or not. Will it cause me to violate God's moral will? If it does, then it's not of God. It's me. And I shouldn't do it. I should trust God and be faithful to Him. And He'll take care of it in His time. According to Time magazine poll taken in March 2009, the percentage of Americans who say they would act immorally including lying or backstabbing to keep their jobs. In other words, we're in a climate where it's hard, it's tough, worried about keeping your job. What percentage of Americans do you think would say that they would act immorally in order to keep their jobs? They would lie, they would backstab, they'd do whatever they had to do to keep their jobs. 28% of Americans in this poll, March 2009, said that they would act immorally to keep their jobs. Temptation. The business world can be a cruel place. I don't need to tell you that. You already know that. As Christians, is it ever right to sin in order to keep our jobs? No, it's not. There's a boundary we cannot cross. In this climate today, it is easy to rationalize our choices for fear of losing our jobs. But God never, ever calls us to do wrong in order to keep what is right. Ever. It is a test. Will we trust God and do what is right, even if it costs us our jobs, our careers? That takes faith as well as discernment, doesn't it? Second principle, trusting the Lord helps us confront injustice, helps us confront the wrongs that are being done. Verse 13. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the mountain at a distance with a large area between them. And David called to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who are you who calls to the king?" So David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came to destroy the king your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die because you did not guard your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was at his head." So David crossed over to the other side of the ravine. He stood on top of a mountain at a safe distance from Saul and his army. And David called out to Abner, the top general in the army and Saul's right-hand man. Now David knew Abner well. He had fought beside Abner in the wars with the Philistines. He had served with Abner in the army. He knew Abner's loyalty to Saul and his pride as a soldier about doing his job, his pride at protecting Saul. And now David calls out to Abner, "Are you not a man?" "Abner, where's the spear? Where's the jug of water, Abner? You haven't done your job. You're not a man. You're not a soldier. You blew it." And David knows the law of the soldier in that culture. You fail at your job, you deserve to die. "That's what you deserve, Abner. You've blown it." Abner has nothing to say to David. Verse 17, then Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" David said, "It is my voice, my lord the king." He also said, "Why then is my lord pursuing his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Now therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is men, cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today, that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.' Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." So Saul answers David. He recognizes David's voice. Probably most of the men there did recognize David's voice. And David makes another speech to Saul. He boldly confronts the injustice that Saul is pursuing against David. David has done no wrong. He has not wronged Saul. He has not harmed Saul. He is a flea. Why should Saul be worried about David? He's a partridge that Saul is hunting in the wilderness, in the wild. He's no threat to Saul. David has proved that time and time and time again already. Furthermore, David charges Saul with something. He charges him with driving him out from the inheritance of Israel. Now, you have to understand the culture of Israel. Basically, David was being cut off from the sacrificial system, from worship, from any connection with his inheritance as an Israelite, his spiritual heritage and his physical inheritance. He was being cut off from that because in Israelite culture, the only way to really be connected with God and in right relationship with God and his people was through the sacrificial system. But David wasn't being allowed to participate. He was cut off from all of that. That's a horrible injustice for an Israelite. In effect, David says, you've been telling me to go serve other gods. Now, David's not going to go serve other gods, but he's been told that effectively. Cut off, injustice, driven out, hunted. It's not fair. You're being unjust, Saul. And David's faith in God helps him confront the injustices of Saul. Do you face injustice in your life? Do people wrong you? They wronged David. He was being forced out of his own inheritance. Sources in India say an especially stubborn elephant has been causing all sorts of havoc along the eastern highways, refusing to let people pass, refusing to let cars pass until they gave some food. He's even been known to stick his trunk through an open window of a car searching for food, not allowing them to pass. One local resident went so far as to call the actions an old-fashioned hold-up. Authorities in India are considering microchipping elephants to keep track of their whereabouts and keep them in line. So strong-armed by an elephant's trunk. Well, Saul is strong-arming David. He is unjustly taking what is David's right as a citizen in Israel. Many today strong-arm others, take what is not right. What do we do when we face those kinds of wrongs in life, those injustices? Are we bold enough to speak out against it? God calls Christians to be quick to speak out against wrongs, against injustice in this world. We shouldn't look the other way when corporations, for example, strong-arm people. We should speak out against abuses of power in our world. We, of all people, as Christians, can speak out against corruption, against abuse of power in our culture and in our world because we trust God to take care of our needs. We trust God to take care of us now and in the future. So the church, you know, is often bold to speak out against sexual immorality in our culture. But how bold are we to speak out against injustice and corruption and greed in our culture? We should be. Abuse of power. We should be. But I want you to notice the limits. David speaks out against injustice here, but he does not take matters into his own hands. And there's a huge difference there. There's a limitation. He'll leave the judgment to God. And the lesson is pretty clear. We are to speak out against sin, but we are to leave the judgment in God's hands. God is the judge ultimately. It's not for us. Scott Roeder was charged this past Tuesday with first-degree murder for killing Dr. George Tiller with a single gunshot as the doctor was handing out programs on Sunday at the Lutheran church where he attended in Wichita, Kansas. Now, Dr. George Tiller, by all accounts, is one of a handful of doctors in the entire country who perform late-term abortions. Let's call it what it is. He has apparently murdered many babies over the years. It's sin. It's wrong. There's no justification, however, for what Scott Roeder did. Two wrongs don't make a right. And he himself has stepped over the boundaries of God's laws. That is not an option for a Christian. Not an option for a Christian to step over those lines. What he did is murder, is wrong. There's no justification. We as Christians, as truly pro-life Christians, must condemn the taking of Tiller's life as sin just as much as we proclaim the taking of babies through abortion as sin. Both are wrong, right? As editorial writer M.D. Harmon said on Friday in the Portland Press Herald, I don't know if you caught his editorial, but he wrote that Scott Roeder decided to take another's life into his own hands instead of waiting for God to act. In so doing, as always happens, he became exactly what he hated. Roeder may have been anti-abortion, but he was not pro-life. He became the very thing he hated. And that's what happens. And that's why David says, no, I'm not going to step over that line. I'm not going to step over that boundary and be guilty before God of becoming the very thing that I have hated, the very thing that Saul is. And that's the line we have to walk in life. We must be able to speak the truth about sin and about wrongs and about injustice and about corruption in this world. But we don't step over that line and take matters into our own hands. We trust God that He is righteous and He is a true judge and He will take care of matters ultimately. Now, God certainly has given systems and justice systems and courts and those kinds of things. That's God's system. But we leave it with God ultimately to judge sin. We trust God. That's a matter of faith. Third principle, trusting the Lord helps us distrust false promises. Verse 21, then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again because my life was precious in your sight. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. And David answered and said, behold, the spear of the king. Now let one of the young men come over and take it. And the Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord, and may He deliver me from all distress. Then Saul said to David, blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. So Saul openly apologizes to David for his sin. He's wronged David. He invites David, come on back. Return to the palace. Everything will be all right. I will not harm you again. I know that you have treated my life as precious. I promise never to harm you again, David. Come on back to the palace. I was wrong. You were right. From a human perspective, Saul seems very repentant, does he not? He's very sincere, I think, from all that we can tell. So when a person is sorry and promises not to harm us again, shouldn't we immediately reconcile with that person and rebuild the relationship with them? What do you think? I'll tell you, no, not necessarily. No, not necessarily. Aren't we supposed to forgive and put it all behind us and go back to the way things were if someone apologizes for wrong? No, not necessarily. We are to forgive, but not necessarily are we to reconcile, at least not immediately. Reconciliation and forgiveness are two very different matters. We forgive the wrong. We let it go. We talked about that last Sunday. That frees us We refuse to take vengeance, but that doesn't mean that we trust the person enough to enter back into a close relationship where they might harm us again. Think of forgiveness as a one-way street and reconciliation as a two-way street. It's got to go both ways to reconcile. One person forgives, but it takes two people to reconcile. Reconciliation requires a rebuilding of trust. That takes time. That's a process. Furthermore, there are people in life you should never trust again. Think about that. Because they have proven themselves untrustworthy. Saul is untrustworthy. David's been down this road too many times with Saul. His repentance is not real. His promises cannot be trusted. David tells Saul simply to send someone to get his possessions. Here's your spear, Saul. Saul says, come on back. David says, here's your spear, Saul. Send somebody over to get it. I'm leaving. He doesn't argue with Saul. He doesn't debate with Saul. But he doesn't go back either. Because Saul is not trustworthy. Saul will return to his palace. David will head off into the wilderness for a number of more years now. This is the last time they will see each other. This is the last time they will have contact right here. David will not trust Saul, and with good reason. There are people that cannot be trusted. That's life in a fallen world. We simply part company with them. We let them go their way, we go our way, and we leave it with God. Because there's nothing else you can do. You can't force someone else to be different, to change. In life's little instruction book, we read this instruction: trust in God, but lock your car. That's pretty good advice. Trust in God, but lock your car. Moms or dads might give that advice to many a young person in life. Trust God, but lock your car. Carl Sandburg wrote, love your neighbor as yourself, but don't take down the fence. Okay. God would have us be wise in our relationships, and wisdom knows who not to trust in life as well as who to trust in life. David has finally learned that no matter what Saul says, Saul cannot be trusted. David can then distrust Saul. This is a side of life we don't often talk about, but David can now distrust Saul because he trusts God. I want you to notice what David says in verse 24 when he's responding to Saul. He says, Saul, just as your life was valued in my sight so that I spared you as you slept, may my life be highly regarded by, and we expect him to say, by you, Saul. Because that's the analogy, isn't it? We would say, look, as I have valued you, so you ought to value me. I ought to be valued by you just as I value you. That's the connection we expect. But you notice what David says? He says, as I have valued you, Saul, and done what is right for you, so may my life be highly valued by God. I didn't trust you, Saul, but I trust him. And I'm going to do what's right in this situation and trust you, God, not you, Saul. That's where my faith is. That's why I can do what is right, because I trust in God to value me, even as I have valued you. We can trust God for our security. We cannot trust really anyone else. We can walk away from those who are untrustworthy because we trust God to take care of us. That's an act of faith. We do not have to feel compelled to please everyone. We do not have to feel compelled to please people who may never accept us. We can move on with life because we trust God to guide us. Our faith is in Him, not in other people. We have peace in the middle of disaster because we know God is there with us every step of the way. It all starts with trusting Him for our lives. We must trust God, move ahead with life, even if it is hard, even if it is tough. In 1993, Lieutenant Colonel Gary Morse joined the Army Reserves as a doctor to care not only for U.S. soldiers, but also for wounded civilians and prisoners of war. In 2005, Dr. Morse, was a part of the war in Iraq. He was called up to serve as the field doctor for a battalion near the Iranian border. Part of his work was to visit two detainee camps to treat prisoners of war. One day, he was supposed to travel by convoy to a military hospital in Baghdad to accompany a prisoner with severe abdominal infection. But the mission was canceled after a bomb hit a similar convoy, returning to camp that day. In fact, for 3 days in a row, the medical convoys had been bombed and people were killed. They had to wait a day, but a day later they headed out. And as he sat in the back of the Humvee with the very sick POW, he asked himself what probably every soldier in that convoy was asking. Why are we doing this for someone we consider our enemy? Why are we doing this for the very people who are blowing us up and killing us? That's what this whole convoy was about. Not only that, as they made their way to Baghdad, he was feeling very lonely, very depressed. It was Sunday, he realized he was going to miss the chapel service once again. And as a Christian, that was really hard for him. They drove along, and as was normal, the Humvees tailgating one another, driving as fast and moving as rapidly and taking action to move around so as to make themselves a less of a target for militants, and right up next to each other, one following the other, so a suicide bomber couldn't get in between. And he looked up, and the gunner in the turret above him was swiveling around looking for everyone that might be a threat. And here he was down in the Humvee with this prisoner of war who was very sick. And the radio man sitting next to him was constantly relaying messages from the convoy ahead back to them to take this action, to take that action. He decided to fight off all of the feelings that he was having by listening to some music on his MP3 player. His son-in-law, Eric, had loaded on the player about 1,000 songs before he left home. Since it was Sunday, he decided to listen to some praise music, and the first song was by the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. And the words go like this: "Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place." Right. Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. I can feel His mighty power and His grace. I can hear the brush of angels' wings. I see glory on each face. Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. Now that's something we sing in a nice, safe place like church. And we look around and we say, surely the Lord's presence is in this place. I can see His glory on all your faces, right? Can you sing that in the middle of Iraq? In the belly of a Humvee. Speeding toward Baghdad, crammed into the back of that Humvee, he sensed the presence of God as never before in his life. And Gary writes, "I felt enveloped by the presence of God. God around me, God above me, God in me. As tears ran down my dusty cheeks, I peered through the thick bulletproof window at Iraqis in their flowing robes, their mud-walled houses, children at play, the tall and stately palm trees. And just as surely as I felt the presence of God in that Humvee, I sensed God's presence in all that I saw here in this desolate country with the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Kurds. God was surely here. God loves Iraq. I was filled with a deep sense of peace. I was still worried about the road ahead, but I had a sense of contentment that everything was going to be fine. No matter what happened, I knew that God profoundly loved every person on both sides of this war. Father, teach us your presence. Teach us your presence in the belly of disaster. Teach us your presence when others wrong us. Teach us your presence in the choices we make this week and the places we go. For you are with us, and we trust you to guide us. In Jesus' name, amen.